Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer Michael Beinhorn. But first, let's talk about the CD extras that entice people to buy them. Well, the British Phonograph Industry, BPI, and the Entertainment Retailers Association, which are also based in the UK, they did a study to find out what actually entices people to buy CDs. So in other words, just the music itself isn't enough. You have to add something else if you really want people to buy your CD. And here are the things they came up with. The first and foremost thing was exclusive tracks that you can't find anywhere else. So in other words, if you give people something that they can't find anywhere else, they can't find it online, then you have a good chance of somebody buying your CD just for that. The second thing is making the disc a limited edition. In other words, just print up 500 of them and then print on each one sequentially one of 500, number 10 of 500, number 499 of 500. That really makes a difference in people's minds because suddenly it becomes a collectible, and that's an incentive for people to actually buy the physical product. The next thing is cover artwork designed by the artist. Sometimes it's not enough that you just supply the music. Your fan actually wants some other things from you that are artistic. And the one thing that really seems to be attractive is if you supply artwork you did yourself. So that's number three. Number four is if you provide something like priority bookings for gigs. If one of your fans buys a CD, and they see a phone number that says, call this for priority booking. That really makes a difference for them because they feel that, in fact, they're a VIP. And making them feel special is really important because, let's face it, we're selling an experience as well as the music, as well as the product. So doing this really makes them feel better. And that's one thing that's really important when it comes to selling physical product. Another thing is exclusive access to online content. So once again, here we come back to this exclusive part. If they buy the CD, they can get something that nobody else can get. That could either be on the CD itself, or in this case, it could be online. So that's another thing important. And the last thing is membership in a fan community. So in other words, they have to buy the CD in order to become a member. And of course, a casual fan might not care about this, but a real fan, this is important. So remember, just having a CD isn't enough any longer. You have to give something else besides it. And these are the things that people are responding to, at least in the UK. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyounderscircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. And now each module is available individually. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Here's something that was announced this week that's very exciting. When it comes to vinyl records, the presses that were used to actually press the records are really old. There hasn't been a new record press made in over 30 years, at least until now. A company out of Germany called Neubild has built the first record presses in over 30 years. This is important for a lot of different reasons. First of all, there are only 21 pressing plants in the whole United States, and all of them are using these old, old presses. And in many cases, some are 50 years old or more. Real problem with that is the fact that you can't get parts anymore. So something as innocuous as a screw might cost $5,000 because it has to be custom made. So all of these parts have to be custom made in order to keep these presses going. Well, having brand new presses actually might alleviate this problem and also alleviate the problem of having to wait to get your product delivered. Because right now, there's about a 4-month wait to get an order delivered. One of them goes to Jack White's Third Man Records, and the second one goes to, I think it's the biggest pressing plant in the United States right now, United Pressing, both in Nashville. Jack White is also buying another one, or at least another set of them, and he's going to place it in a brand new plant in Detroit. So just about all the plants have new presses on order. So I think that this is going to help the industry and that now we'll be able to get product a lot faster and it's probably going to be a lot better as a result as well. Now, if you think that you can buy one of these and get it up and running and maybe become the 22nd plant in the United States, it's not that easy. Just keep in mind that you need a boiler, you need a cooling tower, you need three-phase power, you need an air compressor, and there's a lot of toxic chemicals that you need just to make the stampers. So this is an expensive process, and by the way, a brand new press from Newbuilt also costs about $100,000 each. My guest today is producer Michael Beinhorn, who's worked with everyone from Herbie Hancock to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Korn, Marilyn Manson, Aerosmith, Ozzy Osbourne, Soundgarden, and many, many more. He's also written a great book that I highly recommend called Unlocking Creativity, A Producer's Guide to Making Music and Art. And you can get that on Amazon, and you can probably get it at most bookstores as well. I spoke with Michael from his studio in downtown Los Angeles via Skype. Just from our conversation so far and from reading your book, you've given the whole process of being an artist, creating art, being a music producer, you've given it a lot of thought. I guess the real question is, so what prompted that? Is this just something natural? Is this something that you had to just get it in your mind how to do this?
This is a fantastic question because it did seem kind of out of the ordinary. But, you know, it just occurred to me at one point that there were so many protocols that I kind of had accumulated over years of work that I just sort of naturally kind of gravitated towards whenever, in any given situation. I was like, wow, I wonder what that would look like if I just started listing stuff and just kind of writing it all out and see where it went. And then after I got to about like 20 or 30 pages, I was like, wow, this is pretty extensive actually. And that caused me to kind of take a step back and go, I don't think anyone's ever really kind of laid this stuff out in a manner where other people could see it. And from that, I kind of started to gravitate towards, I don't know, just kind of, you know, really thinking about what my actual, not just what my methodology was, but like tenets, you know, just like a philosophy behind what it was that I did. And when I started to write it down, I was like, this is actually very interesting. If it was me and I saw a book like this, I would want to, and I saw stuff like this, I would want to read a book about it, mm-hmm. You know, and that's really where it kind of came from, you know? So a lot of it is kind of like reverse engineering a process, you know, kind of like working backwards. I mean, I guess I'm reverse engineering my own process and kind of going back into it and seeing what the nuts and the bolts of it are and breaking it down into a methodology that other people, that might be comprehensible to other people.
How long did it take you to write the book? And how long were you collecting this before you kind of like decided to write?
Well, I guess it kind of came in stages. Like, strangely enough, a lot of it, like the basis of it just happened really quickly. Like it just sort of like spilled out of me because these are kind of like, they're almost like impulses, like, you know, responses to things, you know, and a reflex.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it really is like, you know what I'm talking about? Like when something happens in a work situation that involves other people, you kind of have to you have to be prepared with responses to what's going on because in many cases what you're dealing with is something that is either a challenge creatively or something that could potentially slow the process or just stop it dead. You know, at any point in the process, the creative process, these things are going to come up, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of look back at all this stuff and I guess dissecting these reflexes, it really kind of, it just sort of like came together really fast. It actually came together in a couple of stages. Like, I wrote a good deal of stuff, and I had to take out so much of it because a lot of it was really irrelevant to what I was writing. And then I just added a few more things that would kind of round the whole thing out.
Yeah, I know when I'm writing, it's kind of the same thing. I know that it's going to evolve over time. And actually, after I finally got that in my head that, you know, what you write the first time isn't, it's just like anything else, you know, the first time you create something, that's not the end, and you're going to keep on editing. And, you know, kind of once you get comfortable with that idea, then it's easy to throw stuff out. But you're way ahead of that curve because you've been doing it in your artistic life. So that was kind of an easy transition, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And you know, it was really cool to kind of switch from being someone who has to assess other people's work to creating a work like this of my own that was really outside of my familiar kind of milieu, and to do that. So it kind of, you know, that had its own, I guess, well, challenges perhaps, but I've been writing, you know, for myself for a while, so it was kind of a natural extension.
I know your blog posts are very cool. And actually, it's funny because that's where I came to know you more as the writer, because I guess your blog was around before the book, right, I presume.
Yeah.
And I kept on reading these posts and thinking, wow, this is great material. I hope this becomes something more. And it did. A question for you. So there are many instances in your book where you list conversations that you had. Were they real conversations? Real back and forths, or was it just a composite example?
You know what's funny is that each one of those conversations is a recollection. In some cases, what my memory was capable of being able to furnish, you know, some of it was kind of filled in, but it essentially, each one of those illustrates a specific event that took place on a specific recording project, and it kind of obviously exemplifies what it is that I'm trying to talk about, and they're all really interesting. I didn't want to mention names because, you know, I feel like that's bad form. I think it's really interesting. I also wanted to show what like the repartee can be like to people who aren't familiar with it when you're in a situation like that and you're really working with other people's dynamics, and that, you know, how that happens. It gives kind of like are there feeling.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed is you're a master psychologist. I would say, because you know we've all been in those same situations, but you just seem to handle it better. And what I mean is, you start out, and I guess it's the classic way of dealing with these things, where you have a difficult situation and you start out by complimenting the person, by getting on their side, and then in a very gentle way, getting him to look at the problem in a different in a different light. And you just do it so amazingly well and smooth that every time I looked at one of those conversations, I think, I've been there before. Why didn't I do that?
Well, you know, I mean, perhaps that's one of the reasons I wrote it out too, because, you know, to kind of like let people know that there's a space that you can go into where you really, you know, take some deep breaths and you go like, okay, the drama, this person's drama, or whatever drama I'm dealing with right now doesn't have to affect me because I'm essentially running this. I'm helping guide this person. If I get sucked into what they're dealing with, assuming that it's a, you know, tense situation or a dramatic one, I'm not really doing my job or serving this process. You know, so I got to do what I got to do to make sure I'm able to handle it objectively and separate myself from that.
Yeah. Well, just by what you wrote down, wow. And over and over, because it's not in every chapter where you do that, but in enough of them where you, after a while you sort of get a feel. It's like, wow, this is a great method. And however way you learn that, you know, it's terrific. So was that something that was just innate the way you did it, or did you learn that over time?
Oh, man, it's come for me over time. I'm sure that there are people who are much more capable, or at least were able to kind of, you know, get that understanding quicker. I mean, I think when I was much younger, I was much more confrontational. And I didn't have any, I remember doing a couple of things that were just utterly tactless. Like in my 20s, I remember I went with a girlfriend to I took her along with me to a pre-production session of a band I was working with in Canada. And they played a bunch of songs. And after one of them, I was like, well, that just sucked. Or something like that. And afterwards, this girl I was with looked at me and she was like, I can't believe that you said that. Did you see their faces? You know, like you just completely crushed them. And I was like, no, I didn't. And then I thought about it. I was like, oh, yes, I did. I was like, wow, that would really suck if someone said that to me.
Yeah.
You know, so I think in my case, I definitely learned by through doing and through making a lot of missteps. But, you know, I mean, a lot of it comes down to like, you know, putting yourself in someone else's shoes and going like, well, I'm responsible here to a great extent, you know, for this process. And I have to be very careful about what I say to this person because I don't want to do something that's going to put a wrench in their creative works, which is something that we're all depending on.
But the interesting thing is you're still very direct because it's very easy to pussyfoot around the problem, you know, and be a nice guy about it and say, well, it's great and put it in a different light and all. But you become very direct and get to the point of it and in a way that just can't be missed by an artist. That they understand definitely what you mean.
Well, it's a process trying to make someone your ally and at the same, you know, align yourself with them and at the same time make it clear that they have basically brought you into their creative process in order to help them. And part of that help involves critiquing their work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a tough, I actually read something recently that Don Was said about this, where he used the term benign honesty, which I'd never really seen before. And I just love that so much. And it's a great way to, you know, to deal with people, you know. I mean, I've been in situations, though, where artists actually required some, you know, not just confrontation, but like, you know, head on kind of like, look,
yeah,
you know, some artists are asking for that. Like, you kind of have to suss the person out and really kind of feel what it is that they need and what they really on an intrinsic level, what they want from you.
Well, I think I told you the last time we talked, Kelly Scott, who was just on the podcast, maybe a month ago, the drummer from Failure,
yeah,
he credited you with changing his outlook on drumming and basically said that you, if it wasn't for you, he wouldn't be where he was today. And it was, again, the way you did it. And he described your method exactly as the way you describe it in the book. He said that he was all flash. At the time, he didn't even realize that there was something beyond that. And he took him aside gently and said, look, you're not going to be on the project if you keep on playing like this. So take this record, which I think was the Back in Black record, he said, the AC/DC. Learn why this happens over the weekend. Here's a drum set up in the cottage here. And when you come back on Monday, we'll see where we're at, which is perfect. I mean, that's exactly what you describe in your book as well.
See, you say this and I have no recollection whatsoever. It's really funny, but that's how the process goes. Like for me, when I'm working with someone, like I said, it's a reflex. I don't remember any of this stuff. It just kind of comes out. You know, a lot of it isn't none of it is rehearsed. It just happens.
Yeah.
Because what I develop more than anything is like a sense, like a feel for the people I'm working with. And when you have that kind of like innate empathetic rapport with someone where you kind of work on that and you can sense what people feel, it immediately immediately inspires what you need to say to them. Like it just sort of comes out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But I'm just curious how long that takes to develop.
I don't know. You know, I think that I feel personally that every person has an empathetic capability, that they're capable of sensing other people's feelings. I mean, as human beings, we do have natural instincts. And this is part of that instinctual nature, to be able to sense what people are feeling, what they're thinking. You know, everyone's able to do it. And this applies tremendously in making music and in the art of record production. You know, mm-hmm. If you really take the time to be around the people that you're with and sense what it is that's going on in the space and just sense what their needs are. I mean, that may sound a little bit esoteric, but it's really fascinating once you get into that. And, you know, you can just start focusing on minutiae, like how does the room feel? Like when you feel, it's simple, when you feel tension from other people, and everyone knows what that feels like, you understand that as a physical sensation, you know what that is. So you're already using your body as a means to register what your immediate environment is around you. That sensation or that awareness of the sensation can be completely applied in a creative situation working interpersonally.
Which obviously works for you, the way you do it. I mean, everybody does that to some degree, but you've developed it to another level, the skill to another level.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just, it just happens. And I mean, it's something that whole concept is something that I really wanted to share with other people.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel that a lot of people really kind of use a more their approaches can be more systematic, that it's broken down into kind of like a more, okay, this and this, and you know, where the process of recording becomes more of a technical one,
yeah,
as opposed to one that's more expressive and creative.
I never worked with Quincy Jones, but I have a lot of friends that did, as I'm sure you do as well. And that's one of the things they've always said about Quincy, where in a session, he wasn't very technical at all. He wouldn't ask a lot from his musicians, but it was always setting the stage and make everybody feel good and getting the best out of them. Unless something was way out of tune or out of time, which the musicians that he was working with, that hardly ever happened, it was just different. It was setting the stage. And Phil Ramone, too, was like that. You know, then two very great producers. Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that making things feel good for people is really important.
In the beginning of your book, you alluded to a crisis that you had where you felt you became more of a businessman instead of a producer. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. You know, as a producer, I'd become really, really successful. And I got offered a position at a record company. And initially I took the position because I turned down one that was actually higher paying, because I saw this as an opportunity to really inspire more artist development at this record company, which I saw was becoming kind of like a dying art in a sense. And this is like, you know, end of the 90s. So it gives you an indication of how long it's been, I think, since there has been that much, you know, focus on it. You know, so I took this job and I gradually began to kind of fall into a whole different world, you know, where I'm meeting with other heads of record companies and managers and things like that and discussing, you know, working with this one and working with that one, but on behalf of the record company more, and commiserating with the people that were on the other side of the, you know, the recording equation. And I began to fancy that was my world, that was really where I belonged, you know. And it really kind of did it did a number on my head, actually. You know, it was really interesting. And I had to take a step back at some point and see what that expectation, you know, what that impression, you know, that outlook had done to the focus that I used to put on my work, because it had changed quite a bit. And I had to really look at it and go, what am I? Who am I really? You know, and it just came down to one simple thing. I have no idea about business. You know, it's not entirely true, but like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, there are people who can handle that very well. I'm supposed to be in the trenches dealing with artists and musicians. That's something that I do very, very well.
Was there an event that brought that to a head, or was there something that brought that to a head that happened?
No, it was really very gradual. It was really very gradual, you know, but I think like most things, there's usually like one, you know, there's usually a moment of clarity where you kind of take a step back and go, wait a minute, what's going on here? Yeah. You know? that's pretty much, you know, I actually had a couple of jolts along the way where I was kind of like, man, this is just so silly, you know, being having a position at a record company and doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I mean, there's things about it that are very valuable. I mean, it was in, and it was interesting to see what the inner workings of a record company actually function like, you know, on a day-to-day basis. And it really kind of, it brought home a lot of stuff, you know, so I'm, it was a good, it was a good experience in a lot of ways.
Did you find that helpful then in dealing with labels afterwards as a producer?
Yes and no. It was just more understanding the dynamic than anything else.
In your book, you describe two types of record producers. The producer that kind of sits back and lets things happen, and the one that's constantly trying to improve things. I want to, and obviously you're in the latter. I want to play devil's advocate on this, though.
Yeah, man.
So the record producer that sits back and lets things happen is perhaps letting the group, the artist, fulfill what they hear in their heads and letting that happen and just facilitating that rather than trying to improve it. Isn't that true to some degree?
Well, it can be. I think what I was talking about in the book, though, was the kind of person who basically is trying to imprint something on a project that sounds like what they're familiar with.
Yeah, yeah.
That there's a certain kind of, that there's a stamp that they imprint specifically that's based on a systematic approach to the record making process.
Yeah.
You know, I was basically trying to use, I think that there's lots of different ways that you can categorize record producers. And I was essentially trying to make a distinction between people who work from more from a playbook and people who kind of approach it as more of like a freestyle type thing, mm-hmm. you know, which the kind of people that you're talking about could easily fall into, like someone who lets the band do what it is that they're doing. That could be someone who has more of a freestyle approach to how they do stuff. My approach is a little bit is freestyle also, because I tend to work with the ingredients that I've got at hand and try and make the best out of that. And my endeavor is to use all the ingredients that that I have to make the best possible outcome, you know.
Yeah,
someone else who would take a, you know, back seat and I guess be more of like a coach or a cheerleader without getting too far into the artist's creative process is obviously trying to make as much space for the artist to express themselves as possible, you know. And yeah. I think that there are a lot of people who do that very well.
Well, there's obviously a lot that fall into the other category too that have an indelible fingerprint on everything they do.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, you know.
Yeah.
In many cases it's a good thing, I guess. But it's definitely there.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely wanted to make a distinction between someone who gets more involved, I guess, in what I was talking about with someone who's going to get more involved in the process and I think what I was talking about was someone who really kind of who is going to work from a template or an idea that develops as it comes along, that sort of like follows a unique vision for each project, and someone who takes the same sort of systematic approach and applies it to each recording that they do.
You just mentioned about working with the ingredients that you have, and this is a subject that we talked about at length in the last interview, which was the subject of drummers.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, obviously the most important person in the band from the standpoint that if the drummer doesn't work, nothing else is going to work. But that being said, if you're working with the ingredients that you have, that's pretty difficult sometimes. You know, that's a tough one to get around.
It can be impossible, actually, you know, as I've experienced on a couple of occasions, you know. I mean, sometimes people, I think the bottom line is that when you want to make the best record possible, you have to ensure that you do have the right ingredients to do that. You know, in some cases, apart from having the ingredients, I also get a mission statement from the artist that I'm working with. Hey, we want this kind of record. And in order to do that, I have to formulate up here what that's going to look like. You know, how I'm going to be able to achieve that optimally. And yeah, I mean, if you've got a specific directive to follow, it's really imperative that everyone on the project is on the same exact page, and also that they're all capable of operating at optimal levels at all times. Like when they're performing, you want it to sound the way it's supposed to sound, because you know that, or I know, like, I'm a pretty harsh critic of what I'm listening to, but the public, the people who are going to be listening to and hopefully buying these people's recording in some way, shape, or form, they're the ones who are the harshest critics of all. They're 1,000 times more harsh than I am, because they vote with their pocketbooks.
Yeah.
If they don't like you, they'll turn their back on you. You know, so that winds up being the decision-making process at that point, winds up being, when it emanates from me, pertains to how am I going to enact these people's directive to the best of my ability. And sometimes that does mean augmenting the ingredients that are at hand.
On the other hand, you know, there's the other problem where there's something that you know isn't right, and yet you have the artist that insists it is, which becomes another problem, you know, entirely.
Yeah, but the thing is that I have really run into that issue as a systemic issue, you know, or, you know, one that's intrinsic to the artist that I can't get around no matter what, that they just have every block possible to keep me from getting through. Most of the time, even when people are reticent to look at logic in the face and go, oh, crap, he's right. You know, over time, just by using the examples of what's there, like if the drummer is not functioning and someone on the project is saying, oh, but they are, you know, and besides, you have to work with it, then it's a matter of the artist himself hearing what that performer is doing and letting them be the judge. Like, what do you honestly think of this? Is this the basis for the record that you want to make? Is this part of your vision? Knowing what you know. And it's interesting how when you present people with the facts, things do tend to shift. And if you do it in a way where it's not forceful, giving people examples of stuff is almost always the best way. Like on one record I worked on, one of the people who wrote a song that I was doing was not in the band. So this guy came in to play bass on this one song because he had the right feel for it. And the artist actually wanted him instead of the bass player in the band to play. So he comes in and he plays this part. And it turns out there's like a minor second in the bass line, in one of the lines, and it repeats. And I decided that the minor second was too dissonant in the root in the bass, so I shifted it over to the guitar. I was like, this is going to be part of the guitar because it's less agonizing than when you hear it in the bass, you know, because it's instead of like there's a dissonance, it's kind of like, oh shit, like, and it. Completely, it takes your focus away from the vocal. So we moved it there, and the guy comes in. He starts playing the part, and I was like, "Well, you know, I actually took that second out, and I moved it up to the guitar." And he's like, "Yeah, but I wrote that bass line." I was like, "Okay, I understand, but you know, it really rubs badly, and it takes the focus off the vocal." And he's like, "You know what? I don't care. I wrote the bass line, and that's how I'm going to play it." And I just said to him, "Look. How about this? How about you give this a try? If you would just play the root notes as they are without the minor second, and then we're going to go back, you know, and we'll do a little bit with the minor second out and then a little bit with the minor second in. We'll go back. You listen. You tell me what you want to do." And he did it. We listened back and, you know, we're just sitting there listening. He turns around, he's like, "All right, I'll play that goddamn bass part."
But it was his decision. It was great. It's perfect.
Yes, and then he went around telling everyone that I'd forced him to change his bass part. Which I, you know, what are you going to say? It was funny, but you know, I felt in the end that he made the right decision, and I was glad that, you know, that he actually listened to reason.
What do you think has changed in the business? And what do you feel has changed? I mean, there's so many things that have, but listen to me. What's the most impactful to you? What is the thing that has impacted what you do the most?
Oh my God. How long is this podcast going to go on? Oh man, I don't even know where to start answering that question. Wow. In the past, like 15, 20 years, it's been crazy how much things have changed. The recording technology has changed. The playback technology has changed. The distribution technology has changed. The way people make records has changed. The consciousness around how people make records has changed. You know, the resources available, you know, have changed drastically. Like, you just see recording studios going under right and left. And it's not even something that people, you know, get that messed up about anymore. I mean, I remember when, like, in the 80s, when the commercial real estate went through the roof, and like four of the most amazing recording studios in history closed within like a few months of each other, like RCA, CBS, I can't remember, A&R, you know, handful, just like that. And people were in shock. They're like, what? It's been momentous, the changes that have gone on in this industry. And, you know, I think it's all affected everyone. You know, the way that I was able to do a lot of records in the past, you know, involved being really meticulous and spending a lot of time on stuff. And, you know, one has to move very quickly now. Like, you can't, you can't optimize your resources that are already optimized in quite the same way. You know, you really have to work as fast as possible, which I'm not saying isn't an efficient, effective way for many people to work. It's just that I don't see art as being a one-size-fits-all occupation. So I don't think that everyone should be forced to work the same way because they have to work the same way. You know, I mean, if you impose that on people who are trying to make something that's gonna be special, you know, you can really look forward to stuff not coming out as well as might have if perhaps they wanted to work slowly and had a little bit more time to do so. Everything is just so different, you know.
Well, that's because of the budgets. And, you know, again, we have the 1%ers that have no budgets and, you know, whatever they need, and everybody else who's struggling for the most part.
Yep. Yeah. And that makes a big, you know, that makes a big difference. I mean, I feel that that record companies really kind of, I think that they weren't really looking ahead to the future so much. And, you know, a lot of that outlook has really, you know, come back to bite them on the ass a little
bit. Yeah.
You know, it's really forced people who aren't good or who are in their best iteration as, you know, doing very nonconformist work. It's really forced a lot of people to homogenize what they do and really conform to a specific way of working that they wouldn't have otherwise chosen for themselves. You know,
well,
I know many people who are in this position now, and it's hard, but they kind of go, well, that's the only way I'm going to be able to work doing this. So
on the other hand, if you're just starting in the business, you know, no other way, that's just the way you work.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you're being mentored, unless you're dealing with people or talking who can do it a different way. Like, you know, tomorrow I'm going to be speaking to people at like Blackbird Academy.
Mm.
And it's an interesting opportunity to get with people who are trying to who are really interested in making a name for themselves as producers and engineers, and trying to infect their consciousness with a different way of looking at stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so that they're able to kind of, so that it kind of shakes them up and rattles them a little bit and makes them, you know, maybe think, well, maybe there's a different, maybe there are other ways to do this. Maybe this process doesn't have to be a one size fits all thing. And it's not about like, oh, you know, you shouldn't be using Pro Tools. The only good records ever made were made on tape recorders. And, you know, if you don't have a Neve board, it's not a rock record and stuff like that. Like, you know, that's just crazy talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but really kind of getting into the process of making a record and really, you know, and really enjoying the art of it. I mean, not everyone needs to do this. I feel that there's plenty of room for records that are, you know, for trashy pop records.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's just that the whole world doesn't need to be like full of trashy pop records.
What's interesting about your book and your philosophy, really, I guess, is that it translates to the arts in general, not just music production. And
yeah,
you said that, in fact, a lot of people that outside the music industry, you know, really are digging the book, which I can see why. Was that intentional?
Not really. No, I never thought about it like that. Only after I started reading stuff, when I started reading it back, I was like, wow, this really translates to so many other things. And, you know, at one point I was like, wow, it's a shame that I'm writing specific to recording. But I think you can see through a lot of that if you're in a different discipline. And a lot of that can be applied elsewhere, which is good. Yeah, it wasn't intentional, though. You know, but it just shows how universal all these different disciplines really are.
I know one of the things that really helped me is in all creative endeavors is when I kind of learned how to write. It took me a while, but what I found that works best for me, I don't advocate it for everybody, but it's a three-step method. And the first method is stream of consciousness. The first pass I do on anything that's creative is stream of consciousness. And I don't try to get too cute with it. I don't worry about being precise at all. And that freed me up a lot, I got to say, because one of the things that I think really inhibit people is the fact that if they don't get it perfect out of the box, they feel, oh, I suck. You know, there's that. But, you know, the thing about it is, except for the few geniuses around, which, you know, again, there are very few, just about everybody has that problem. You're going to be editing, you're going to be changing, it's going to evolve. So I developed this three-pass method, and it was for writing, but it turns out it works for everything else. The first is stream of consciousness. The second pass would be more a refinement, where I'd actually kind of make things make sense. And the third would be polishing, and polishing would be fine-tuning it. And then I might even do a fourth or fifth. And then I realized after that, it just got different. It didn't get better.
Mm-hmm.
But when I learned to do that with writing, all of a sudden, I found myself doing it in everything else, and it seemed to work with everything else. Again, only for me. I don't advocate it for anybody else. I'm just saying this works for me. So, but it just goes to show you, once you learn your own personal truth in creation, it kind of works in any kind of creation.
Oh, man, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what you've described as a method is it not only makes sense, it's perfectly logical, you know, because the stuff that comes up stream of consciousness really is you kind of unadulterated, unexpurgated, you know, and you can certainly come back to it and tailor stuff accordingly. Like, that doesn't make sense, but I know what I'm trying to say. Yeah. So I'm just going to hone it a little bit, so the idea comes through a little bit better.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's wonderful, man. That's great.
Yeah. It's always worked for me. A couple more questions before I let you go. I know you're busy. This is a deep, dark one. What scares you about the music business?
That's a great question, actually. What scares me about the music business is this kind of... There are a couple of things. There's a really intense sense of divisiveness going on right now in the music business, in the industry overall. that's disturbing. And there's also a lot of recalcitrant, there's like recalcitrant behavior on the part of so many people. There's so many factions now. You know, mm-hmm. it's got to be like this. It's got to be like that. You know, I mean, I suppose for that matter, I'm in somewhat of a faction myself, even though I would love to be, you know, to help bring people together more and for everyone to find a common purpose. But, you know, there's so much greed and fear that, like, seems to pull at people and drag them off in a direction that really puts them at cross purposes with other people doing the same thing. And that kind of behavior really affects other people, you know, because they pick up on that and they're kind of like, oh, shit, you know, then I better be ready with this, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got people who say streaming is evil. You've got people who say that vinyl is the way forward. You know, you've got people in record companies who are kind of like, the only way you're going to have a hit single is if you send your artist off to, like, you know, these, you know, groups of, like, writer producers who will, like, you know, give them, you know, hit songs and, you know, make them the next, like, Katy Perry or something like that. And there's all this divisiveness happening where people are really kind of fighting. You know, at certain points, I think that there's always been factions within this, but I don't think that there's ever been this much fragmentation, where the fragmentation is actually affecting the fabric of the industry, and it's also affecting the monetary aspect of it as well. You know, because these fishers are really making it very difficult for there to be a consensus on what's happening, how to deal with it, how we're going to get compensated, you know, how this will happen, how that'll happen. I was actually speaking with a friend today who was telling me that he'd gone to Washington to talk with legislators about, you know, copyright law and all the changes that are going on. And he was like, it was really interesting because he spoke to a lot of people in Washington and they all had the same tack. They were like, look, I always thought that they saw the music industry as small potatoes, you know, which compared to a lot of other industries, it is. But really, they were saying to him, you guys have there's no one point of consensus anywhere. You know, we can't act on your behalf because we don't really know what you all want.
Yeah.
You know, we're afraid that if we do anything, we're going to piss someone off.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So that, I mean, which is really interesting when you take a step back and look at it. And the recalcitrant part of it is the fact that people are so entrenched in their belief system. And it's really turning into not just kind of like, okay, this is my opinion. It's turning into, this is my belief. It's like saying, I'm a Christian, you're this, I hate you, you know?
Yeah.
It's like people aren't willing to kind of cross that divide and go like, all right, what we got to do is find a place in this where we can all agree, you know, where mm-hmm. we can actually make inroads. Because if we don't do that, you know, this is one thing that's really interesting to me. One of the founders of the women's movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. How do I remember that?
Yeah, I know. Wow, I'm impressed.
She was... You know, it was her and Susan B. Anthony. And this is interesting because Elizabeth Stanton was really good. Like, she knew what her position was, but she was really good at reaching out to people from other groups that you would never have associated with the women's movement. Like, people who are very, very, like, strong Christians, for example. And this is, like, in the, you know, late 19th century.
Yeah.
And she was able to find common causes with these people. She was able to look past and get them to look past differences that each movement might have with another and get them to kind of align with her cause. Well, interesting, right?
It is. It's kind of the secret to world peace, isn't it?
It's really? Well, that's why she was a great leader. I mean, if she'd been a man, she probably could have been president.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is interesting because I think her husband was like the Secretary of, like, Defense or War under Lincoln. But this is what we're missing, you know, that there's so much pulling and so much, you know, people kind of being like, no, you know, like a bunch of little kids. I'm not going to hear what you have to say. You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you know. And meanwhile, we're losing ground every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And that to me is like, that's the toughest thing. Like, it's this kind of these opinions that are getting kind of that are getting ingrained more and more every day in people, and they're and you know everyone's really angry and kind of you know not willing to see the other side, and you know you read stuff about executives in record companies who are getting paid like $20 million a year while their company's falling apart, and they can't like you know they can't pull anything great out of their ass at all.
Yeah.
You know, and you can tell that a lot of these people are just waiting to, you know, until they hit retirement and they get the heck out and that's it, you know, which is also really sad. You know, you would think that people who have gotten out of this whole thing, who are kind of veterans, that they would be, that they would actually be willing to get back in there going like, wow, I've gotten so much out of this business. The least I could do, the very least I could do would be to bring anything back to it. You know, I mean, I apologize for going off topic a little bit, but relative to this, like I have a friend who is putting together funders for a movie about how the music, you know, how the music industry is being, you know, decimated by, you know, by all these factors, strangely enough, right? And he goes to a bunch of like old timers, you know, who are retired and all that, and, you know, people who've made a lot of money. They don't want to know. They were just kind of like, I'm out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just as simple, like, I wash my hands of it completely. It's like, did you never care about this? Did it never mean anything to you at all? Like, wow. Like, I just couldn't find myself thinking like that. I'm sorry. Like, it's just so, it's so foreign to me. Like, come on. Like, isn't this something that ever mattered to you?
Well, there's a difference, though, between, you know, a career and a passion. And for some people, it's merely a career. It's merely a job, especially if, you know, when you get a real job in a label or a publishing company, it's different than you and I who, you know, 99% of musicians who are entrepreneurs, basically, and they're making, you know, every day is a new gig. So you can only do that because you're passionate about it. And there's a big difference. You know, again, you can, it's easy to lose your passion in a job, I think.
I agree, you know, but also, you know, some of the people we're talking about were actually record producers who were kind of like, you know, who kind of like were in the thick of it and made like really, really great records, you know, like it just, it kind of like, it kind of spun me out a little bit to hear that just because I was like, wow, I don't know how old I could possibly get before I would feel like, meh, it's not my bother anymore.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you either received from somebody or you learned along the way?
Read your contract. Probably.
That's a pretty good one. You know, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot. There's a lot, really. Read your contract. Like, you know, don't get yourself into anything that you're going to regret later on, and make sure that you're really clear about everything that you're doing. Because one of the worst things that can happen is that you kind of go, I know so many people, and I am a prime exponent of this, by the way, of going like, you know, sitting there and musing, mulling over something for a long time and going like, you know, weighing out the pros and the cons, and there are like red flags going up everywhere. And I'm kind of like, at the end of like a day or so, I'm like, I can do this. Yeah. You know, what the heck? You know, I like to fight the good fight, and then getting in there and like a couple of months down the road going like, what the hell did I sign on for?
Yes, know? We've been like, there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, just like look at each situation carefully, weigh out the pros and the cons. And if something smells funny to you, you know, follow that lead. And don't let your other nature, you know, the nature that's kind of like, I can do this, you know, I'm a man, I'm strong enough, or, you know, whatever excuse you want to make to yourself, you know, that's the voice of experience talking right there.
Well, as always, this has been a load of fun. I hope we can do this more because I always enjoy talking with you. And I urge everybody who's listening to go get Michael's book, Unlocking Creativity.
Thank you so much.
It's a great book. It really is. And it doesn't matter if you're a producer or an artist or if you like to paint or whatever the case, it will work for you definitely. But and it's also a fun read. I really enjoyed it. There's a lot in it, but it goes fast.
I'm glad you feel that way. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, man. Really good. Michael has a great blog at mjbphd.wordpress.com. That's M, the letter M, letter J, letter B, PhD, mjbphd.wordpress.com. And he shares his deep inner thoughts on the music business. You'll find it very entertaining and very cerebral, and you'll learn a lot as well. You can also find his book called Unlocking Creativity, A Producer's Guide to Making Music and Art on Amazon, and I really highly recommend you check it out. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Many, many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.